You're listening to Solving Climate Naturally. Join us as we unpack nature's role in tackling climate change and talk to the people leading the way.
Welcome to Solving Climate Naturally, where we speak with experts and leaders at the cutting edge of natural climate solutions and help demystify this growing field. We're your hosts. I'm Julia.
And I'm Kate.
Thanks so much for joining us, Akash. We're so excited to have you on the podcast today. And I remember first meeting you back at outside the Mitchell Building, I think, at Stanford, when you're at the School of Earth, now the Doerr School of Sustainability. So great to have you on the podcast to talk about the work that you've been doing since then. And thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Longtime listener, first time caller.
Akash is a remote sensing scientist developing methods to measure components of the water and carbon cycles using instruments deployed on phones, drones, planes, and satellites. He's the co-founder and CEO of Working Trees, a startup focused on leveraging mobile sensing technology to improve science and transparency in tree carbon monitoring. His doctoral work focused on developing satellite-based models of groundwater mass changes in California's aquifers, for which he received the Exceptional PhD Thesis Award from Stanford University's Geophysics Department in 2022. Akash previously worked as a support scientist in the Hydrological Sciences Lab at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, where he constructed satellite-based models of flood and landslide hazards. He has also developed remote sensing software at Ceres Imaging, a successful precision agriculture startup, served as a National Geographic Explorer, and interned as a GIS analyst at World Wildlife Fund. In addition to his PhD, he received his master's degree in Earth and Environmental Sciences on a full scholarship from Boston College and holds a bachelor's degree with honors in geosciences from Franklin and Marshall College. Welcome, Akash. So glad to have you here.
So we've heard the official bio, but would love for you to tell us a bit more about your origin story. You've worked at World Wildlife Fund, ag tech startups, and as a NASA research support scientist, and have your PhD from Stanford. But what brought you into this world of nature-based solutions?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in the climate and the environment and our natural world. But I would say that a lot of serendipity is really what brought me into nature-based solutions, and the best kind of serendipity. So the common thread between the work I've done and the jobs that I've had is it's kind of remote sensing and sensing technology to measure, model, and monitor the natural environment or the built environment. And, you know, as I was exploring in graduate school and trying to peel back the onion of what are some of the most potent things that we can do to really address climate change, nature-based solutions kept popping up as a really potent and high-impact opportunity. But also noting that there were various barriers associated with technology, monitoring, and sensing technology development specifically, I saw an opportunity to get involved and try to apply some of my skills and background to solve some of these pressing challenges.
Can you talk about sort of your background in remote sensing then and what sorts of, you know, technologies or problems that you've worked on in the past?
Would love to, yeah. So I worked on water resources for about 10 years. I was a research support scientist at NASA from 2015 to 2017. I was using satellite data to build models which monitor floods and landslides in real time. So, you know, after that, I was totally hooked. I had caught the bug of sensing technology and remote sensing. I worked at an ag tech startup for a year called Ceres Imaging. They were building these high-resolution cameras, putting them on planes, flying them over agricultural fields, and delivering analysis around water stress and nutrient uptake and things like that. Then I went to go do my PhD. Again, satellites are my hammer and I'm just looking for nails for a long time that was the case. And my PhD work focused on developing physics-based models to understand changes in aquifer systems in California. So floods to droughts and monitoring the changes across multiple spatial scales and developing new ways to leverage free satellite data to provide up-to-date and accurate monitoring capabilities. It's been a bit of a departure from the satellites in working on Working Trees. We use more mobile phone-based sensor devices, but that's been a really fun area of research and challenge to undertake too.
So in other words, you're a bit of a newbie to this world of remote sensing and satellite imagery. You know, have only been new kid on the block there.
I'm always learning. No matter how much time you spend, there's always more to learn. You learn that pretty fast.
Well, since you have been in this space for over a decade, how has the tech changed in the last 10 years?
you know, there's, given that salamandry has been around for a while, you know, I'm curious, but there's a lot of hype and a lot of conversation about it now in particular. Why is that? Like, how has the tech changed in the last 10 years?
Yeah, well, it's getting better. It's constantly improving. It's getting cheaper. And we're doing new things with existing sensors that hadn't really been done before. And a lot of that is brought about by advances in computational power, you know, and cloud computing and big data and the ability to process large volumes of data, kind of fuse together different data sources that were previously only used one at a time. And then I'd say the pace of innovation in both the space agencies, so at NASA and the European Space Agency and other space agencies around the world, is really breakneck. Like, we have new satellites getting launched multiple times a year, some of which are recording new forms of measurement. You've probably heard a lot about NASA's JEDI satellites that use lasers to map forest height. NASA just launched another satellite last year called the Surface Water Ocean Topography Satellite that, again, uses radars to map water levels in new ways that haven't really been done before. So the innovation in the public sector is really catalytic, but also the private sector is having big impacts too. Companies like Planet Labs, like Capella Space, other satellite data companies are really like increasing the amount of data volumes out there and unlocking some new applications that haven't really been possible until now.
And so what's the origin story for Working Trees? We understand it was sort of founded out of Stanford with some business school students as well. Would love to hear how that started. And especially, you know, what problem were you looking to solve? How has that evolved and what are you doing now?
Yeah, so we met in 2021 in Stanford Climate Ventures class, and we were kind of united by shared passions around climate change and rural economic development and trying to come up with solutions to tackle both at once. And we had some broad ideas as far as ecosystem services and how we can use markets to catalyze improvements in our ecosystems and the climate. And, you know, I would say that early in that class, we kind of realized the raw potential of trees as a climate solution. Like, we're talking 5 to 10+ gigatons per year, according to the IPCC. But beyond that, they're also the cheapest, right? Like, they are profoundly cheap and we already know how to plant them. So, you know, lots of opportunity, low cost, seemed like a no-brainer to move towards that. And, you know, we're trying to ask the question, you know, if trees are so beneficial in terms of not only climate, but biodiversity and water, and they're cost effective, and they can provide economic value to the land stewards that manage them too, in the form of fruits or nuts or other nutritious products, why aren't they being kind of rolled out in a bigger and more catalytic way? And there are a few barriers you folks know better than most, but two of the key ones: technology to monitor the impacts over time and financing to pay for the upfront installation. And on the finance, let me just talk about the financing piece, because I think we'll focus a lot on technology, but financing is definitely a huge barrier. You know, these trees take time to provide benefits, whether those benefits are fruit and nut production, or they might be shade for livestock who are heat stressed in the sun, but they take a few years to get big enough to provide these services, and they cost money to plant now. So how can we bridge that gap, right? Like, and provide financing for these activities when the benefits aren't going to occur until years in the future? And so we started probing this area and identified sort of carbon markets and carbon payments as a solution to bridge that financing gap. And I know that your listeners are very climate savvy and carbon market savvy, but I'll just quickly in one sentence kind of describe how it goes. Basically, an individual or a company who is seeking to abate their climate footprint and their carbon footprint offers up money ahead of time for the carbon sequestration that will occur in the future by planting trees now. So we can give that money to farmers, help them plant trees, and then we develop technology so that they can monitor at low cost. And this is just exactly what we started doing with a handful of ranchers in the eastern US. And that's kind of how Working Trees got started. And we really carved out this interesting niche where we were working with these ranchers. They have a heat stress problem with their livestock. So it gets too hot in the summer. Cows go into heat stress, they stop eating, and they're less productive. They're at risk of disease or death, God forbid. And obviously, the ranchers who manage them don't want that to happen. So how do you fix that problem? Well, you can plant trees at low densities on the pasture. And there's lots of research that shows that as long as you're about 50% canopy cover, you don't really lose any grass production. But none of these folks have the money to do these activities or the time, right? They're super, the median farmer struggles to break even. The median rancher in the US struggles to break even. And, you know, they're busy. So how can we bridge this gap? How can we kind of give them the resources that they need to solve not only, you know, their specific problems related to heat stress, but, you know, improve the resiliency and productive output of their operations simultaneously? So that's really how we got started and the entry point into natural climate solutions and agroforestry that we pursued.
So tell us then about how your business works today. You mentioned or teased a mobile app in the beginning. Tell us more about what is the product that you're offering and who your customers are as it relates to agroforestry and, you know, ensuring that we can get more trees in the ground.
Yeah. So I'll just follow up on the origin story bit a little bit, but we develop mobile phone applications to cheaply, quickly, and accurately estimate the amount of carbon stored in trees. And what it looks like is you basically take a couple of measurements of a tree and you snap a couple of photos and we record lots of data like the latitude and longitude coordinates. And initially we developed this technology to help limit costs associated with monitoring our silvopasture agroforestry plantations that we were working with farmers to stand up. However, pretty quickly organizations started knocking on our door. And I'm talking about dairy companies or NGOs, lots of organizations who had existing tree planting projects and just wanted to use the software to do their own monitoring. And the amount of interest in that activity was actually surprising to us, and it was far exceeded what we had expected. And because of these kind of market signals, we elected to double down on the technology and, you know, provide that as a service to organizations, companies, NGOs who are looking to account for tree biomass sequestration in their operations. So that's our core business model now, but we still do lots of work with farmers and ranchers.
How's the business going? How big is the team? And what sort of insights have you gleaned in the last couple of years?
It's going well. We're going strong. We've been at this full time for a little over a year. We've got 6 full-time employees. We've got 7 or so folks who are kind of part-time collaborators, including some interns. And we have 5 wonderful advisors who are both science and business advisors. And yeah, I think we're excited to, you know, to deploy this technology widely and have a great impact, you know, quantifying and catalyzing ecosystem restoration around the world.
So what's hard about your business? You're saying that it's going well. We got a solid team. I don't know how you do everything with 6 people. I'll just say that. Like, it sounds like that would be challenging. But, you know, what have been the barriers to scaling? And what are sort of the struggles that you're facing and as you think about growing the business?
Yeah, good question. Well, one of the key kind of barriers that we're seeing right now in our conversations with organizations who are seeking to kind of deploy climate smart practices in agroforestry and so on within their supply chains is that they're in a bit of a holding pattern waiting for regulation to drop. And you might have seen, I think it was yesterday or the day before, the SEC released some updated guidance on emissions disclosures, including sequestration and accounting, and actually putting it into accounting rather than just like an ESG report. So that's exciting. But what we found is that a lot of organizations, even with really ambitious goals, are waiting for this regulation to hit so that they don't have to pivot or start and restart their activities when the new regulation drops. So yeah, essentially like lots of folks are in a bit of a holding pattern, which makes it tougher to, you know, kind of just hit the ground running and deploy these projects like now, which is when we need it the most.
That uncertainty in the market definitely keeps people on the sidelines, right? At a time where we need to have more capital going into the market and to get these solutions off the ground and ensure that we can be driving impact today and have the supply and scale that we'll need tomorrow. And, you know, both the regulatory uncertainty, the NGO standards uncertainty, it's a big challenge. And kudos to the companies who are taking action now despite that uncertainty, and to the other folks in the market who recognize that we need to take action today. And there are really high integrity ways to do that. So just want to shout out to all the listeners out there who are still taking action.
Plus one to that.
Would love to hear a bit more about the aspirations. What would you like to achieve this year? Where would you like to be in 5 years? What's sort of the big goal?
Yeah, I mean, we have five wonderful customers. We're managing thousands of trees and measuring thousands of trees on thousands or hundreds of acres at present. We're looking to help other companies and organizations sort of embark on their decarbonization journey using natural climate solutions as a lever, specifically agroforestry, to achieve that. So like I said, we've got five customers looking for other partners, collaborators, ways to grow the business and grow our impact. And I mean, we have pretty audacious and ambitious goals to, you know, catalyze restoration of 1 million+ hectares of degraded land globally and sequester, you know, many, many millions of tons, if not gigatons of carbon while we do that. And that doesn't even begin to touch on some of the other benefits that those activities could have. So yeah, I think to summarize, our goal is to expand outward in particularly the food and beverage industry, where a lot of these organizations manage complex supply chains as it is, and they have a huge opportunity to deploy agroforestry and other tree planting projects on those lands and really see through that impact from deployment all the way through, you know, the length of the project. So decades in the future.
So how have you financed the business to date? My understanding is that you haven't taken VC funding yet. Is that right?
We took a safe note to kick things off from Alpine Social Ventures. Shout out to the team at Alpine. But we've been vast majority funded by non-dilutive grants. So we've been really successful partnering with Virginia Tech, partnering with the Nature Conservancy and other organizations, landing USDA grants and other non-dilutive funding sources. And we have revenue, right? Like we are generating revenue from five customers now. So we've been fortunate enough to be able to allocate some of that to grow our operations too. That said, you know, I think we're seeking partnerships and financing and investment in a number of different ways. And so if that is of interest to folks, the phone lines are open.
Yes. How are you thinking about that, the kind of financing that you are interested in and what kinds of partners are you looking for? Just, you know, there are different ways to finance nature-based solutions, different types of capital, and, you know, different for the businesses that are engaged in this space, from project developers to tech solution providers. You know, I think that there are different types of capital are suited for different types of solutions. So curious to hear how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So given the, you know, focus on the technology side of the business, we actually think we're a pretty good fit for venture capital funding or venture investment funding, given the kind of return profile potential and margins that a technology-focused business can have. That said, you know, we still support a dozen or so farms in the U.S., and we have farms that we help out with their planting and management in Brazil as well. And the finance and return profiles for those activities is not really a venture backable activity. And so, you know, I think, Julia, you alluded to more catalytic capital, like more project finance type mechanisms. I know that you and some others are doing some interesting work in this space. And so, you know, we've spoken to a number of foundations or sort of accelerator type investors who are mission driven and who are patient and who don't need to see the 10x plus return profile over 5 years that a venture capitalist might need to see. And I think that's going to be a really, really important component of driving natural climate solutions forward, to bridge these kind of financing gaps that aren't going to pay out for a number of years. And it's partially because it just takes trees a long time to grow, especially in, you know, northerly latitudes.
So this is obviously a tech episode. So let's talk more about the tech. Could you share a bit more around what the solution is that you're using today and maybe what's in the future product roadmap as well?
Yeah. So let's quickly talk about how you would measure the carbon stored in a tree like today. And the way that somebody would do that is you get your tape measure and you get your clipboard and you literally just go and stick the tape measure around the tree and record its circumference. And you might have to travel a great distance to do that. You probably need more than one person. You probably want one measuring person and one scribe. And then you might have to measure lots and lots of trees. And then, you know, go and collect all your data. You go back to the office and you input all of that into a spreadsheet. And then you're ready to do your carbon calculations, right? So if you talk to any arborist or forester or researcher who's had to do this, they'll tell you like it's not the greatest. So what we do is massively simplify and streamline that process without sacrificing accuracy using the tools already in our pockets, so mobile phones. And essentially, our phone application, which you can download in the App Store or the Play Store right now, uses augmented reality algorithms to model surfaces and measure distances. And so you kind of just walk up to a tree, you place a point at the bottom, you swipe up to set the height, you are guided where the correct height to measure the diameter is, and you just kind of tap the left and the right sides of the tree to estimate the diameter, and boom, you're done. It takes like less than 2 minutes per tree. And then the beauty of it is we automatically record all of the metadata, like the latitude longitude coordinates, like the timestamps. So that's already in the database. And I should also mention, we've done peer-reviewed research in partnership with Virginia Tech to vet the accuracy of the tool. It's more than 90%, even across a number of different users of the phone application who are part of an older age demographic, so not the most tech-savvy or tech-forward group, which was great because that's exactly what we wanted to test. And then you can also collect, all the data can be collected without cell service because these are remote locations that we're talking about. It gets stored locally on your device. And then when you get back on Wi-Fi or in Signal, it gets uploaded to our database. And so how does an organization kind of use the technology to understand their operations and the sequestration resulting from their activities better? Well, you take a bunch of measurements using the mobile phone, and then you can log on to our website. And we have this online monitoring dashboard that shows on a map all of the locations of the measured trees. It shows all of the calculations that describe how you convert those measurements of diameter and height into actual carbon stock estimates. It talks about, and all of the math and the calculations are all there, so you can unpack it and view it for yourself. And then there's also summary statistics, like there's this many trees growing, this many species, here are all the photos. So if you want to check that out, we have a public-facing version of it at dashboard.workingtrees.com.
Awesome. I could see the usefulness of this in a variety of different contexts. And I'm curious who your target customer is. So, you know, there could be project developers or validation verification bodies or companies that have agricultural supply chains and that are thinking about investing in silva pasture and putting in trees and into their agricultural fields. So I guess I'm curious, how have you thought about your target customer and who do you see as the target customer?
Yeah, like you said, there are lots of different use cases where somebody might be able to benefit from this or an organization might benefit from it. But we're really leaning into the food and beverage company segment. And that's for a few reasons. First is incentive alignment as far as supply chains. Like these companies have a lot of incentive to improve the climate resilience of their supply chains. And they have the rapport and the trust with landowners built over decades that can really catalyze adoption and help roll out these practices at scale. We're definitely not against working with project developers or anybody really. I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, our customer is anybody who wants to accurately measure their trees faster than they would be able to otherwise. But for the reasons that I've just mentioned, as far as incentive alignment and supply chain and scalability, like CPGs and food and beverage companies, we view as a segment who really needs this, especially given all of the regulation that's coming to those verticals in the coming years. And indeed, our early adopter customers are mostly in this segment.
And just jumping back to the technology itself, I mean, we talked in the beginning around obviously your background in the GIS space and the new satellites coming online. I'm curious, you know, right now, understanding it's sort of a mobile-based application, is there a way to combine that with some of the satellite imagery and combine this, you know, very granular ground truthing data with something that can scale with satellites? Is that in the roadmap, or what would be the challenges to that sort of approach?
Yeah, it's a great question, Kate, and it's really one that I get all the time. Like, why don't we just use satellites to do that? And look, like I said, I love satellites and I'm not trying to drag them. So satellites are wonderful tools if you want to check that the forest is still there or if it's gone, right? So they're amazing, they're scalable, and they have incredible coverage. However, if you need to measure the carbon in a tree that was planted 3 years ago, you are just simply not going to be able to do that with satellite data. And if you think about kind of how a tree stores carbon, 50 to 80% of that is actually in the trunk. And if you think of the imaging geometry of satellites, it's top down, right? So you're not going to really be able to get a good measure of the most critical property to know, or the part of the tree that actually stores the most carbon. So there are some like fundamental limitations with current form of satellites and the current forms of the data that we collect. However, you know, they are getting better. The resolution is improving. We're coming up with new and really innovative and clever ways to do things like map canopy height using lasers and things like that. There's some new exciting stereo imagery satellites coming out that would actually give you a three-dimensional structure of objects. But those are still kind of R&D phase. And what you will always need for satellite data is ground truth training data to calibrate and validate your models, right? So you need this high quality ground truth corpus of training, essentially training data that we're collecting pre-digitized that will go in and feed the machine learning and AI models of the future. And some of the satellite companies out there that are doing excellent work in the carbon space have actually approached us saying, you know, we have this same problem as everyone else, which is that we need to validate and verify our models, and doing the field work to do that is expensive and time consuming. So, you know, the way that we're positioning is you can use our app or you can use data that we've already collected to speed up that calibration and validation process. So I really view us as being, you know, complementary in kind of solving this problem at multiple different spatial scales as we look to the future.
One technology you didn't mention was LiDAR, and maybe I think it's used in measuring canopy height or structure, but what are your thoughts on LiDAR? How useful is it? Is it hype or not?
Oh, it's amazing. It's super cool. A big plug for JEDI, the Global Ecosystem Dynamics Investigation on the ISS. Yeah, LiDAR is a super cool tool. And just so we're clear on how it works, like, you know, shoot photons at things. Some of them bounce off the top of the tree. Others bounce off the bottom of the tree. And by the difference in the time that it takes for those to bounce back to the sensor, you can back out the height of the tree because photons travel at the speed of light. And so you know the distances, you know the travel times, and so you can estimate the height. Now our iPhones are shipping with LiDAR, and those kind of improve the accuracy of the measurement that, you know, we can do with the phone application and sort of unlock some kind of new and interesting applications. Yes, LiDAR is an amazing tool. However, like the JEDI satellite has a 15-meter footprint right now, which means that, you know, the pixels are only 15 meters. So if you have a tree that's smaller crown than that, it's going to be hard to see. And then airborne LiDAR can be extremely accurate, extremely high resolution. It's just expensive to deploy. So yeah, love LiDAR, great tool. There's also some interesting work happening. I think it's at Meta right now, where they're training non-LiDAR data from satellites on LiDAR data and kind of extrapolating carbon stocks that are calibrated essentially on this really high quality data. So check out that paper if that's your cup of tea. But yeah, LiDAR, great tool. Currently too expensive to be really scalable though, as far as the airborne platform, and currently too low resolution from satellite to give us what we want.
I was just going to ask as well about soil carbon. That's the other hard to measure piece here. What are your thoughts on the best ways to measure soil carbon today and in the future?
Yeah, I am definitely not an expert in this. So I, you know, take this response with a grain of salt. But I think there are some really innovative things happening right now. For instance, like the spectroscopy technology that Yardstick is developing seems really promising. So I view that as a really like potent potential measurement and monitoring solution. You know, for trees, we have the benefit of them like being visible above ground and tangible and like, you know, very measurable. Soil carbon is only sometimes like a few percent of the total mass of soil, which makes it, you know, not only challenging to measure, but if you're even uncertain a little bit, it can throw off your soil carbon stocks quite a bit. So I think it's quite honestly a tougher problem than the problem that we're dealing with. That said, I think there are some really promising new approaches that are gaining momentum.
So we talked a little bit about the benefits of use cases of remote sensing and digital monitoring, reporting, and verification. And many carbon market actors, including myself, view it as a critical piece of the puzzle for increased transparency, reducing costs, increasing speed of verification, improving measurement. But it's really hard to tell what's real and what's hype in this space unless you have the technical expertise like you have, Akash. And so I'm curious, what do you think are the biggest benefits of DMRV today? And what's hype? And how can we non-tech savvy folks tell the difference?
Yeah, well, I think you kind of highlighted some of the really key benefits of DMRV, like transparency, auditability, traceability, just transparency into the process, right? And it really gives the opportunity to guide end-to-end scientific rigor throughout the process because everything has a digital footprint that can be traced back to measurements and so on. Then there are so many more benefits, right? Like streamlining operations and making things faster, making things cheaper, making things more auditable. Totally agree with all of that. How do you distinguish the vaporware from the real stuff? That's a good question. I think, you know, like one thing that we do, we're super committed to science and like peer reviewed science. And like, that's my DNA as a geophysicist and a remote sensing scientist. And so I think having independent peer review or some kind of independent assessment of technology conducted outside of the organization or vetted by somebody other than the organization is important. Like white papers are great, but I want to know what an expert in the field thinks about the white paper or how they would improve the white paper or what suggestions for follow-on analyses that they would give for a white paper. So I think, you know, embracing the scientific process, inefficient as at times as it is important here. And building the trust and the transparency and the credibility and the scientific rigor into these tools is a process, right? Like sometimes that step can take way longer than even developing and testing the technology, but it's worth it for the assurances as far as, you know, the actual data that we're collecting being high fidelity and being understandable and usable by many, many sets of actors. I think that the peer review and following the scientific method is just like the only way to do it to ensure that the level of trust and the level of quality and fidelity that we need to make these markets function efficiently can actually be met.
Well said. And I think there's attention probably for the VC-funded businesses who are moving fast and who want to get that validation and get their product out there as quickly as possible and to deal with the scientific process, which is, you know, inherently slower and takes more time. And so maybe that's another conversation for a later date is like, how do we bring these different stakeholders together who have different incentives, working on different timescales, different funding sources? How do we get them to work together? Because that is for the better of the whole ecosystem overall and to drive the impact that both the entrepreneurs and the scientists want to see in the world. So anyway, Akash, this was really fun. Thank you so much for joining. We're going to do our lightning round of questions. So to start off, favorite carbon sink?
Well, obviously it's trees.
We have some people who are very passionate about other forms of carbon sinks. So,
yeah. I mean, there are so many good ones out there. Shout out to mangroves, like shout out to peatlands. Yeah, I mean, every carbon sink is a good carbon sink, but my personal favorite has got to be trees.
Awesome. Favorite book?
I'm going to go with one that left an impression on me when I was much younger, Slaughterhouse-5 by Kurt Vonnegut.
If you had a magic wand, what would you change to scale NCS?
I would require Scope 3 emissions disclosures for every public company today. And I would also wave the wand to put billions of dollars of project financing available for project developers and other restoration activities.
Awesome. Hope the SEC is listening to this podcast right now, given their ruling. What gives you hope?
As funny as it sounds, like the regulation that came out this week, like does totally give me hope that we're headed in the right direction at the policy level. Also young people who are just super passionate about climate and leaving the world better than we found it. Yeah, there seems to be like kind of a sea change in the mindset. So that's really encouraging.
Awesome. Prediction for the biggest NCS, so Natural Climate Solutions headline of 2024.
All right. I bet that the SEC bill or the SEC law that just was passed a few days ago will not be the last big regulatory shift we see this year.
I'm hoping it's for the positive, not negative. Well, thank you so much, Akash, for joining us, helping us just understand what's vaporware, what's not, sharing your Working Tree story and all the work that you're doing. Congrats. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. And big fan of the podcast and look forward to being a listener in the future.
Thank you for joining today's episode of Solving Climate Naturally. Check out our website, solvingclimatenaturally.com, to see this episode's show notes, explore resources, and learn about upcoming episodes. Let us know what you think by connecting with us via email or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. See you next time.